Welcome to Roadcase, the podcast that explores the live music experience. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Josh Rosenberg, and I'll be taking you on a journey through in-depth interviews with performers and key people in the industry to explore the magic of live music, how it can be totally transformative for both fans and performers, and we'll look at how they take it all out on the road. It's going to be a great ride, so here we go. Okay, hey everyone, this is Josh Rosenberg. I am the host of Roadcase. Welcome to Roadcase. So happy to have you along for this episode with Greg Ormont of Pigeons Playing Ping Pong. So psyched to have Greg, so psyched that you're all here. I want to remind all of you that there's a number of different ways that you can get involved in the Roadcase community. Really quick and easy ways to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, or X, and Facebook. We're at Roadcase Pod. You can also get in touch with the show by emailing us at info@roadcasepod.com. We'd love to hear from you. And if you want to find out more information about Roadcase, you can go to our website. We're on that worldwide web at roadcasepod.com. You can check out all kinds of different things on that website, especially places to other places and places where you can listen to this podcast, all those fun streaming platforms that you're listening to now. Really great way to help support Roadcase is to follow us on the streaming platform. So if you're on Spotify, there's a little box that says follow. Just hit that. Apple Podcasts, there's a check mark up in the upper right-hand corner that you can check that. And while you're there, please rate and review Roadcase as well. That's much appreciated here. Thanks for being here for this interview that I'm doing with Greg Ormont. Greg is the frontman and guitarist for Pigeons Playing Ping Pong, who have a new album out as of April 26th. It's entitled Day in Time. I love this album. Please go out and listen to this album. I've been a big fan of Pigeons for quite a while, and they're just one of my favorite jam bands out there, mostly because of Greg, who I've got on the show today. Greg's just such a great human. He's thoughtful. He's smart. He's fun-loving. He's a dad of young kids, super dedicated to what he does. And we talk about just kind of his life story. We talk about his love of cheese, among other things, but we really get down into it. And I'm so glad that I can bring Greg to all of you for this episode. We're going to get right down to it. Thanks to everyone for being here on this episode and for your continued support of Roadcase. So happy to have you along for this ride. Got tons of great episodes coming up too, so stay tuned for those. So we'll get right to it. I just want to give a quick shout out and thank you to Greg Ormont for being here on this episode of Roadcase. And here we go. Hey, Greg, great to have you on the show, buddy.
Thank you, man. Happy to do it.
So great to finally see you. I'm glad that we got this together, and I'm so glad you got this new album coming out, Day in Time.
Well, I can see our old album, well, yep. What will be old, right behind you. So right, I'm sure you just do that before all of the guests come
well,
on.
Well, I mean, I can't leave 17 albums up there, but I was like, oh, I have perspective, so I'm going to put it up in the mantle. And
oh, that's awesome.
And there you go, right on cue, man. we worked that out nicely.
I know this is a audio platform, but I just got the vinyl of
Indicate
Day in Time.
Indicate guest showing new album. Is that like the first, like run of ones that'll go to the store?
Yes. You are probably the first out of our camp to have seen it for a quarter of a second as I showed you here.
Nice. I love the cover. It's really what I haven't really studied it that much, but what is it?
You know what? Like similar to Music Man, like, and I'm happy to talk about song genesis and whatnot, but I like you to figure that out, right? It's one of those kind of things where like not to be a highfalutin artist, but you know, once we've made it, it's up to you to decide what it means to you.
Fair.
You know?
That's fair.
And I mean I get reminded that all the time, whether it's from our album art or songs, like people will tell me this song meant X, Y, and Z to me, and I had written it with A, B, and C in mind. Like it was the true opposite.
Yeah,
exactly. I'm like, wow, all right. Yeah, I guess it is yours now.
Interesting. Well, that's always got to be interesting, right? I mean, that's songwriters, that's kind of a common occurrence. I mean, no one's going to interpret it a certain way. And you're putting together words in a way that's meaningful for you. And other people are going to interpret it in other ways.
Or maybe I'm just way too vague in my lyrics, and it can really just be
that's kind of the flip
choose
side
your own adventure.
Yeah. Well, you know, both of those things work. I mean, those are not opposing theories that can't exist as one, you know?
Yeah, that's the two things are true thing. I'm really trying to
the two things are true things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it means something to me and it means something to you. Neither is, you know, they both can coexist.
So you don't have necessarily an ownership. If someone says something completely out of left field, what impact does that have on you? You're like, oh my God, how did you come up with that?
I mean, I don't overthink it. I do. It does just remind me, like, not to, like, if I have this message in mind, if it makes sense to me, that's good enough. I don't need to overthink if this is going to make sense to others, because no matter what, people are going to come at it with their own perspectives and experiences and, you know, where they are that day, that time in their life, and take it however they need to. So it kind of just reminds me not to overthink it.
Yeah. Do you get out and talk to fans? You have an opportunity to talk to your fans quite a bit, because you have a very special relationship with your fan base. I mean, I've been to your shows. I'm a fan of Pigeons. I like what you guys, I love what you guys do. And I've seen the beauty of the fan base and that positivity that you bring and that radiates throughout. Do you get a chance to talk to people from time to time?
Well, first off, thank you for, you know, liking the band, man.
You're welcome, man. My pleasure. Know. Thanks for doing what you do, dude.
Yeah, it's a joy, truly. But yes, I love talking to the fans. You know, we used to, after shows, like way early in the day, we'd go out and talk to like every single person. It's helpful that there weren't as many people there be able to pull it off.
And it's helpful that there are too many people now to do that. I'll say that part.
It is cool. But yes, I love talking to the fans. Not about to hear like, you know, oh, you know, like you go fishing for compliments. I just enjoy like getting a feel for who we're playing for, because if you don't do that, you don't quite realize, you know, oh, well, this is this person's first time seeing us. This is this person's 100th time seeing us. This person just went through a loss. This person just got engaged. Like, it kind of helps color the night to get a feel for who you're playing for. And I personally keep that stuff in mind. Like, we started doing these VIP programs specifically to start meeting the fans more. It just makes it a lot easier to meet before the show and kind of keep their stories in mind as we put out the energy. It's part of that cyclical energy that happens in our scene.
Oh, that's cool. Do you actually keep that in mind?
Totally.
Yeah, you have that makes an impact on you.
100%. And then I'll see them in the crowd and I'll be like, you know, just recently, speaking of engaged, we had someone propose with us as part of the VIP meet and greet. He surprised his girlfriend.
At a meet and greet.
He hit us up beforehand. We knew it was coming.
Nice. Okay.
We just didn't know who it was, right. Or I didn't. And then, you know, it happened. She said yes. It was glorious and exciting. And then that night, we're playing the show, and I see them in the crowd, and 100% I'm thinking about them.
That's a wonderful story.
Thinking about the love there. And then similarly, like, oh, this helped me through my addiction, and I see them smiling, and it you know, it's nice to have some context, because oftentimes in a concert for the band, you don't really get that opportunity to know who you're playing to on a more intimate level.
Yeah. And understand what kind of impact that it has on your fans too. I mean, I do think performers do that. Frontmen do understand that impact. But that's a great just a one-to-one correspondence of kind of what you do. But you really make and I'm saying this because I've seen you several times perform and I've admired what you do, but you make no qualms about your own personality, your own positivity and what your mindset is. And that really comes across. And, you know, I'd like to talk about that quite a bit. And am I wrong in saying that you're a positive, real super positive person?
You know, I think
I'm going to interrupt you. It could be one of those things where, you know, I'm kind of misinterpreting it. I don't know.
No, you're right. It's just, again, like two things are true. So on stage, that's where I feel like the energy is flowing out of me in a positive way. I feel like I'm on a mission to make people feel as incredible as I do, especially when you combine the adrenaline of being on stage and the big shiny lights. Like, it's a really exciting experience. And I love to kind of put that out and see if it'll bounce back at me and help the whole room kind of feel how, you know, excited and happy we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there is a misconception that like I'm always happy all the time.
Well, no one can be.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, am I a positive person? Am I optimistic? Absolutely. Do I find myself in valleys in life to match the peaks? Of course.
No, well, you know, Greg, please note, I did not say, are you perfect human? That's 100% positive all the time.
Yeah.
But there is kind of a vibe that's out there. Yeah.
Oh yeah. But I mean, on stage, it's my happy place. It's my comfort blanket. It's just where I feel most alive. Except, you know, barring my wonderful relationship with my family and kids and stuff like that.
Yeah. Congratulations on, your little one's now one. You're father of two now.
Yes. I have a kind of 4-year old, and one, 4-year old daughter, 1-year old son. And, I honestly think of parenting so far has felt like dog years in that I've been a parent for over 4 years, which makes me feel like I've been a parent for about 30.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's a full-time gig, man. It's pretty wild. I used to get sleep at home and rest up and recover at home, and now I'm like, oh, I can't wait to get on a tour bus rolling around and get some sleep, you know.
Oh geez. All right, that worked. That's an interesting perspective. Yeah.
Yeah, it totally flipped.
Yeah.
Totally flipped.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's your wife that's at home. She's at home taking care of the kids.
Yeah. Yeah. She's at home with, my two little maniacs and, yeah. So
cute. They are so adorable, dude.
Oh, thank you so much, man.
Yeah.
Thank
you. Oh my God. Yeah. Fatherhood, man. I got three. They're much older, 26, 20 and 18. So I've been there. I've done the ride. I did the math for your oldest, your daughter, and she was born right after the pandemic hit.
Right.
So
after,
that must have kind of actually been good timing for you in the sense that you did get to spend a lot of time with her early on.
Here's some more two things are true, right? So it was incredible in that regard. Like I never thought that I would be home for like literally the first year of her life. Mm. I, you know, now that touring has resumed, I'm here, I'm gone, I'm here, I'm gone. Like I pop in and out. But the pandemic provided us with so much family time with our firstborn just to like adjust and nest. And, you know, it's a long honeymoon phase of being a new parent. What is also true is that there was a full blown pandemic that was targeting like the immunocompromised, like elderly or newborns. So we were also riddled with stress. You know, we definitely erred on the side on like, I'd rather look back and, you know, roll my eyes that I was too careful than not careful enough. So we were like scrubbing our groceries and quarantining our anything, you know, our mail. And it was just so over the top. And you're already pretty stressed out about like your child's health your first time around anyway. And if you toss on this pandemic that like no one really knew what the long-term implications were, it was also incredibly stressful.
Yeah.
But hindsight being 2020, I mean, I was fortunate in my little bubble that it ended up being really nice for family time. But obviously, I have plenty of compassion for those who had a much different COVID experience.
100%. I mean, it's the best of times. It was the worst of times. But I see your perspective. I mean, I kind of looked back and just did the timing. And like you were home with the baby, I completely forgot about all that. I mean, I had the pandemic in mind, obviously, but yeah, that total paranoia of that time was just bonkers. Anyway,
well, you're already paranoid. You're like, oh, wash your hands before you touch the baby. That's right, before right, like yeah. we have this unknown. Particularly, it was the unknown portion of it. You know, I think that's with anything in life. Like anxiety is going to come when you don't have like an answer to. Yeah, at least give me the fate that I.
Well, when the wheels start rolling in your head, like making up your own answers to stuff that you really can't answer, that you have no control over.
So, like you know, I have an older sister, but I had the first grandbaby for my parents, and they didn't get to meet her for some time because we were just in paranoia mode, and and that's what people were doing anyways. But I mean, she was born April 6th, and we had to stop touring March 17th. So this was in the first month of quarantine. So people were already, you know, saying hi, you know, distance in the yard or even on the other side of a glass door, and with the baby, and it was. But again, like both things are true. I feel so fortunate to have gotten that time with her. Truly.
Absolutely. Yeah. Totally.
I never I had never once considered that. And that's another lesson in like, don't stress about the future too much on the things you can't control. Cause I was worried about, you know, how long will I be home on quote unquote paternity leave before I'm back on tour? And what will that be like for my wife? And how am I going to do this? And maybe I could do this, that, the other. And then like a pandemic came and I was home for a year and we had a whole bunch of other things to worry about.
I mean,
and enjoy,
talk about
you know?
An incredible example of like just not throwing yourself into the future because you don't know. One reason is because you don't know what can happen. Two, you can't control what's going to have these external forces that might, may or may not occur. That's like the biggest external force that all of us have experienced in our lifetimes. Wait, you said March 17th. I was at the last show at the Madison Theater. That was March 11th.
Were you really?
Was
it March 11th?
Yeah.
Well, that's
wondering if I'm missing something.
No, that's perfect because I have a very bad band historian. Just as a caveat for our interview, I'll do my best.
I'm not going to put you on the spot, dude. I got the set list up.
Yeah. March 17th, March 11th. Either way, we got a nice little anecdote out of it. You know, we learned something about ourselves. Was it totally accurate? In my head, it was until you brought it up.
Right. Sorry to dispel that notion of your accuracy, dude.
It was still within a month she was born.
Yeah. No, you got April 6th right, though, because I wrote that down. Yeah. Someone was like scrolling through your Insta just to look for some fun stuff. And
that's funny.
I thought, oh, April 6th. Yeah. Oh, your wife was pregnant during that time. Right. During that tour with Goose that you guys did in the West Coast run. I talked to your bandmate, Alex Gator Petropoulos, drummer extraordinaire. He was on the show shortly thereafter. I think I had him on mid-2021. So we talked about that tour quite a bit. I'm here in Chicago. I saw you guys at the Riv on that tour. And then I drove down to the Madison Theater because I'm friendly with the Goose guys. And Coach was telling me, you got to come to Covington. And
Oh,
I brought my son to the, my youngest is 18. Yeah.
Right.
We were at that show at the Riv. That was fun. Where you did that bus bit outside the Riv. Do you remember that? That was a really cool behind the scenes thing about being in the bus. And you guys did a lot of really fun, zany pigeons kind of things on that, in that video. It was really cool.
Sounds like it was a blast.
There was a lot of cheese involved.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. The digital tour bus. The bus tour.
It was fun.
We're big cheese advocates, man. And funny, like when I, one of the hardest things about recording albums is that I go on a cheese and all dairy break for my voice. Cause you want
least.
So I like, you want like less, mucus and stuff in your system.
The word of the day is phlegm today. So,
oh, perfect. Well, I didn't want to gross out our listeners, but no, it's helpful to have a clear nasal passage and throat. And so I go on a fast from all dairy for about like 3 weeks before we start recording. And I also need breaks in between, you know, I usually do about two or three vocal songs for about, you know, 6 hours or so. And then like my voice starts to, you know, get tired. You can hear it, you know. It's a lot harder singing in the studio because in our shows, yes, they're 3 hours long, but there's lots of jams and there's, you know, I sing a chorus once and if I nailed it or didn't nail it, we move on. With the studio, it's just literally over and over and over, 6 hours straight singing, besides like a couple, you know, vocal breaks. So it has some wear and tear. So then I have a few days off, maybe a week off, maybe 4 days off, and then come do it again for 12 songs, 11 songs. I'm not eating cheese for a long time. That's why I tell this the timeline. It's about 2 months of no cheese. And for anyone who knows me, we literally have a song about our love for cheese. So that's my big sacrifice for these records.
Oh, what song
is that? Oh, it's called Say Cheese. And it's very goofy. It's from my project. But it's all about my love for cheese and my disdain for a specific kind of cheese, the one that got away here.
What's your favorite?
What's my favorite cheese? Oh my God. I don't know if anyone's ever asked me that before. It's like
saying that you dislike that one cheese. I won't even it out of respect for you, brother.
Okay. Well, yeah. People know how I feel about feta, but that's besides that. I mean, it depends on what we're eating, right? You almost want to think about like your breeze and whatnot, but that's just not true. But it's very much, you know, what are we doing here? Are we eating a sandwich or we got a cheese plate going?
True. I was going to say, it's also kind of mood based too, because like,
totally.
How you can't say like, what's your favorite child also? Like I have a favorite, I tell you what, the favorite cheese is the one that I happen to pick intentionally for that moment. And then I move on to the next day. Like, and I spend a lot of time in Italy. I love my cheeses.
Oh yeah.
Oh God. I go to, you know, I lived in Rome recently, about 10 years ago when I was still married, we lived in Rome with the family.
Oh, cool.
2010 timeframe. I still just, and I was just back over the holidays celebrating my 60th birthday. I'd spent 2 weeks in Rome.
Oh man, happy birthday.
Thank you. So I love going to the grocery store and just like, I don't go to the markets, man. That's just too complicated and there's just too much going on. Grocery stores, man, that's where the real people, that's where you get your cheese. That's where it all lives. You know,
oh, yeah?
Cheese, meats, sliced meats. Do you eat meat?
Oh yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. I don't want to, you know, ruffle any feathers here, but yeah. Oh, just picking. Oh, I tell you what, I do have an affinity in Tuscany, in the region in Italy, north of Rome. They have an incredible sheep, like a incredible tradition for sheep cheese. That there's all sorts of different ones. So you get invecchiato, which is aged, or you get newer ones that are just softer and creamier, or you can get kind of in the middle. Then you pair that with a nice wine. I'd have to say that's kind of my favorite.
And then now you're just showing off.
What sense? Being in Italy, knowing about Italian. Does this sound snobby? Exactly. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just teasing. I just want to go there with you.
Yeah.
In fact, my wife and I really want to go to Italy at some point. We both took Latin in school.
Oh.
And if we don't go to Italy, it will be all for naught because neither of us are lawyers or doctors.
You go to the Vatican, so, actually.
Right.
If you go to the Vatican, you can speak Latin with like the guards and stuff. Like that's the next.
I can't speak Latin.
Well, you could try. You could try.
I could say always wear underwear in Latin.
Always wear underwear. Okay, go.
Semper ubi sub ubi.
Ubi, okay.
Always wear underwear.
Semper, yeah, right.
Yeah.
The structure of the Latin language is very interesting. I think I really kind of need to take it in that lot. Just I putting the verbs in a certain place and like it's, I love language. Romance languages, you know, I speak a little French. I speak Italian very well. So it's
you
so
probably pick up on Latin then because that's the building block for all of it. But that sounds awesome, man. I would love to go out to Rome.
How'd you study? You studied Latin.
Well, I don't know what I was thinking. I truly wish I took Spanish. It's just a little more practical. But,
yeah, a little, slightly more.
I don't know. I had a lot of academic pride growing up. I made good grades and studied and whatnot. Was I just seeking external validation? Probably. But nonetheless, doing well in school and Latin, like I did see myself like when I was going into middle school, like could I get into something really brainy, like being a doctor or a lawyer or something like that? Yeah, I could see that. My life went in an utterly different direction.
Yeah.
But I'm very appreciative of all of the cultural stuff that we learned and the mythology. And now you can understand why I'm singing about Poseidon. Because I learned about Poseidon, the god of the sea, for years. I feel like there are other references that
I'm
pop
trying to
up
think of some
lyrically.
But you studied classics then?
Yeah, I mean, we attempted to translate the Odyssey and the Iliad, or you know, all these different things.
You went pretty deep. Are you talking high school? Are you talking college?
I did middle school through like AP Latin through senior year.
Wow. Nice.
There was we would do this. There's this thing called Saturnalia, which I'm sure I will explain poorly, but it's like a big, you know, it's basically like a big Roman party.
Yeah.
Where they would like, you know, probably overdrink and be lavish and overindulge.
Right.
And we would have Saturnalia in high school. And I happened to win, I think, 3 years of Mr. Rome.
The biggest partier in high school. Why does that not surprise you?
Well, no, I wasn't the biggest. This was a school function, and I probably was like the nerdiest, like Latin student who wasn't afraid to, you know, present or speak on stage, you know. I was the best show
Mr.
pony.
Saturnalia.
Okay, no, Mr. Rome. Mr. Rome.
Mr. Rome. Well, the Greek equivalent is Bacchus.
Right. Yeah. So it was like Bacchanalia.
Yeah. Exactly. So, I think that's more like familiar to people.
But instead, it was probably like a Latin decathlon, you know. That type of deal. It was run by the teachers. There was not a rager. I may have been Mr. Rome off campus as well, but I don't know. I had some more stiff competition.
So grades for external validation. So were your parents putting pressure on you? You dropped that. I'm going to pick right up. You knew you were hoping I wasn't coming back to that, brother.
No,
I mean, that's okay too. Like, you got to have motivation for grades, right?
Well, yeah, I didn't feel pressure from my parents, but I did feel the appreciation, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and I think I learned to crave that quite a bit, you know, I'm so proud of you. You made an A+ or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
With some reflection and growing, I'm looking to be more concerned about how I feel about things than how others do, and I do think I'm getting there.
Has that specifically been a journey for you?
Sure. Yeah. Huh. I mean, I think it's one of those things you grow up and kind of recognize where your motivations lie, and I'm pretty introspective these days, especially when you start to have kids. Oh, yeah. You start thinking about what you know, how was I raised? What did I love about it? What would I do my own spin on? I think it's most importantly is how you feel about, you know, how do you think this painting looks? How do you feel about your outfit today? Did you try your best on this test, as opposed to, you know, how did you do in comparison to others? What do I think of what you're doing? You know, because ultimately, as you grow up, I mean, it's all about, you're the one who you're living with. You know, you're living with yourself all the time.
Yeah.
You see your folks here and there. You see your significant others, but at the end of the day, you gotta be true to yourself, right? I mean,
100%.
It's an obvious one, but yeah.
I mean, ostensibly the most important relationship you have is the one that you have with yourself. Because if you don't have a good relationship with yourself, then you can't really have a good relationship with others.
Sure. Yeah. So, that being said, I am in a profession where when we finish what we did, whether we think it's good or not, there's going to be cheers, and they can be loud or moderate or soft. I wonder what people think of this new album, but I am incredibly proud of it. So the rest can let the chips fall, you know?
Yeah. Interesting. Wow. Okay. So many different directions. We're going to unpack a little bit about that. The amplitude of cheering. Are you literally hearing that a little, like exactly how loud? I mean,
of course.
Making comparisons from after one song, after another, at the end, at the curtain call, for encore, from show to show, from song to song, within a show?
Well, it's another version of what we all know in the jam scene, is that the band is feeding off the crowd. And, you know, like if we, you know, can hear the crowd when the lights go out and we're walking on and it's particularly rowdy, and then you finish the first song and it's almost as loud as maybe the end of the show would feel, you're like, oh, well, it's we on, it. I guess. Yeah, yeah. I guess. Uh-huh. Or just that, like, we're all, you know, all the stars are aligning for a fun night, you know? Other times, like, if we're always appreciative of a nice cheer and whatnot, but if we feel like maybe the response is dragging a little bit, that might fuel me in a different way to go kick some ass and be like, all right, you're gonna make me work for it on this one. Fine, right. Bring it on.
That's kind of the flip side. If you think you really brought it and maybe you got kind of a sort of not as much of a ovation as you thought you'd maybe deserved during that song, that motivates you.
Well, I wouldn't say deserve, but yes,
that particular performance on that song, you felt maybe it merited, so you felt really great about it, and maybe the reaction that you're hearing wasn't what you maybe expected. I don't know if you're really like drilling down to that micro level for that, but no, just kind of to explore what's going on.
Yeah, you hear the crowd, whether they're, you know, that whether I want to or not, I have ears. So I take in what they're giving me. And I guess what I'm realizing is, like, whether it's a positive or I feel like we could get this party going more, I'm able to channel that into more oomph and motivation. Like I never am like, oh shucks, I guess this one's gonna be a dud. I'm like, oh, you think you're gonna like take it easy tonight? All right, let's go, bring it on. You know, I take it as a challenge. I'm a bit competitive in that way.
Interesting.
And it's a win-win. Like I it's like you're chasing a high that, you know, remember that show that was so much fun? All right, well, that's gonna be tonight, you know? Oh, you're not ready?
Let me stomp you. What makes a show fun for you then, and how do you take things up a notch? What are some of the things that you can do?
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, for one, it's just like I'm a lot about intention. Like we're saying, like, oh, you're not impressed? All right, bring it on, man. Let's go. Watch this, you know, mentality. But then, you know, there is a diminishing return there. And then maybe you're like, I don't ever want to be forcing it. Like if I'm what I'm describing is a natural, oh, yeah, bring it on. But if I start trying to elicit an emotion without focusing on what's most important, which is the music, then it's not authentic. It doesn't work that way. So when all else fails, you just got to listen to your bandmates and latch on to what they're doing and go back to basics and sync up as a group. Those amazing shows are the ones that the energy's there and the music and the like telepathy is just unconscious, where you know, everyone has open ears on stage. Everyone is tuned into what each other are doing, and we're picking it up without any difficulty or lag. And that's where, like, you know, with anything in life, like if things aren't going the way you should, you go back to basics. Like, all right, why does my back hurt? Oh, my feet aren't flat on the ground. Okay, now let's work up to the knees and the legs and the hips, and then yes, there's my spine. You know, so yeah.
Interesting.
There's a couple different ways to get into it, but I really try to stay out of my own way, like mentally. Just really, we work so hard behind the scenes, practicing with each other, practicing on our own, writing material, you know, rehearsing it to a T, practicing improvising even, to the point where once you're on stage, now it's time to like let your mind go and ride the wave. I mean, it's the classic musicians, like, learn your scales and forget them kind of thing.
Yeah. Practicing improvising seems like an oxymoron, but what I gather from that is just sort of practicing being in the moment with one another, jamming on your own.
Yeah. Rehearsing jam or, you know, at band practice, having open sections of musical exploration where you are where we can take really big swings where there's no stakes with no one watching. We can really, like, if we crash and burn, which is rare, but if we do, like, we can stop and discuss, like, oh, well, I was implying the six here, but I see that you were kind of still riding the two. So maybe next time we can, you know, like we were able to kind of diagnose and discuss things in a way that you can't live. I mean, especially because we don't use, if you're familiar with talkback mics on stage, where you can, there's
so
like
each band
those
member,
who don't,
just for those who don't, each band member can talk to one another.
Yeah. There's a microphone that doesn't go to the crowd. It just goes into the musician's ears. The in-ear monitors we wear, we don't use that, but some bands do. So there's a lot of benefits. You could be like, all right, on the next, you know, four count, let's just switch to drums and bass. 1, 2, 3, 4. And then all of a sudden, as if like magic, the drummer's bass is playing and probably the lights are right on them too. So there's like a lot of advantages in that regard.
Yeah.
But a disadvantage, which again is it's part of the ride. Like, so we've specifically chosen not to go this route. If like we're improvising and it's clear that like three out of four of us are going one direction and one of us hasn't latched onto it, we can't be like, hey, heads up, we're taking this major. Instead, we really need to focus on our ears and pay attention. And I think without that safety net, it leads us to be way more active listeners, way more in the moment. And it, you know, those brief moments where we're not all on the same page creates a tension that is so exciting that when it releases, that's why we like jam music, right? Like it's a choose your own adventure. And sometimes, you know, you need a little dark before the light, or, you know, valley before the peak, whether it's intentional or not.
Right, right. Where it feels like it's getting the most crazy. And then you bring it home is sometimes when that really hits home the most with the crowd.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There's that organized chaos that all of a sudden becomes really organized and no longer chaotic.
Right. Yeah.
You mentioned that you'd use talk that you don't use talkback mics. I was listening to the Gator interview that I did back, like I was saying, in mid 2021. He'd mentioned talkback mic. So was that something that you've changed recently, or what, did I not hear it correctly from Gator?
It probably came up because it is a bit of a topic of contention with the band. Not everyone agrees that we should not have one.
And I don't have a dog in this fight, by the way. I'm just like just trying to explore it with you guys.
Yeah, no. So we have never used talkback mics, to my recollection. There was maybe one show where it was on stage, but not used. Like one show ever, maybe. Again, not a great band historian, but no, it probably just came up as a tool that some folks use. Some of us think it might be helpful, particularly for like so recently we we played a show that was packed. It wasn't a huge place, but it was slammed. Mm-hmm. And it was rowdy and fun. People could hardly dance. And then all of a sudden, while we were jamming, we heard like the over the PA, like, everyone please exit the venue. Like,
oh,
in
yeah,
the
that
middle
was the fire
the
marshal
set.
Show. And it was in the middle. Yeah. I went back. I was like, I wanted to go check that out because I just, when I was listening to Gator, I like thought like, oh shit, there was the fun. Cause I was looking through a couple set lists to see what you guys have been up to recently. It was during Shine On You Crazy Diamond, by the way.
Oh yeah. We had just started.
And I only know that cause I just looked like, what the fuck was going on with that?
Again, I'm not the best historian, but the fire marshal story was we were playing again. It was totally slammed. Like this venue was packed to the gills and it was fun for us. I mean, we have plenty of space on stage and everyone seemed to be having a good time.
Yeah. It's okay for you guys. It doesn't comfortable up there. Well,
and we bring down this jam and kick off Shine On You Crazy Diamond with the classic, you know, doo dee doo doo. Everyone's super pumped. Right. It's like very chill and exciting. And as we're about to kick into the song, we hear over the loudspeaker or the PA, like, ladies and gentlemen, this is a fire evacuation or something like that. Please step
shit,
out.
Oh, shit, that's ominous. It's not like he didn't say, this is the fire marshal. We're...
No, they
that
they
sounds like there's a fucking fire in the building.
Well, it was something like, it was basically like, please evacuate. This is not a drill. I'm like, so because the reason that this came to mind is like, so we don't have that talkback mic. Our crew could have talked to us through our ears, but like, if I had been told this was about to happen, I could tell the rest of the band that this is about to happen. Instead, we were like completely blindsided. Dark. Had no, like, we were playing music, so I could hardly hear what that announcement was. Later, I found out that it was saying, please evacuate. All I heard was like, and everyone's like, ah. So we were very confused. We did not know if we were able to go back on. We had to leave like in the middle of the song. I could have not teased everyone by starting that amazing, well-known intro had I known we were about to give everyone blue balls, and that was the end of the night. That was the first set. So in moments of like, you know, you're at a festival and there's lightning on the radar and you might have to stop, like that might be helpful to have some
for the extreme examples. Of course, it's always good to be able to talk to one another, but you can always just walk up to Jeremy or walk up to Ben or whatever.
I don't know, I think there's something. Like, I think not having a talk back is kind of like a purist's mindset.
Is it a point of pride in the jam band community from what you know?
You know, I don't know. I think that like performers care way more than fans do. You know, I don't think that fans like will see a talk back mic and then a cool transition occurs after someone speaks in it and they're like, bah, that didn't count. Like all they want is a great show. And I think it could lead to a lot more. You know, you could be a little more technically creative on your transitions and whatnot. At the same time, we have our own version of communication from the smallest facial twitches or what have you that, you know, we can cue each other to some extent. Not as much as you could if you were literally talking, but we have plenty of nonverbal communication happening on stage to chug the train along.
Yeah, sure. And I'm sure those are the kind of things that you practice when you're talking, when you're doing those jammer rehearsals that we talked about.
Exactly. Yeah, that's where they can come from. Like next time, let's just do this. So we all know that like, we're going to return to the previous improvised theme that we had just played or until that becomes human, or like our own groupthink human nature, and then we don't have to cue them. You know, like when we were younger, we had way more cues, and now we can just kind of flow because we know each other's tendencies.
Yeah, and when you're in a rehearsal, will you go, okay, we're going to jam inside Avalanche, we're going to jam inside Poseidon, or do you just kind of, or maybe those aren't the best examples, I don't know. But would you, will you do a song, like, let's go jam this thing?
Well, I think our jams in practice are more just free form. They're not in the, within the context of a song. And when I refer to like the two and the six, like the musical language, you know, a scale of do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, do is one and re is two and three. So there are certain chords, like there's different types of minor chords that are very similar. And the only difference between those chords are like, where the, you know, where the third lies, like for instance, major and minor, the third and a major third makes that happy sound, a minor third makes that sad sound. So there's certain like markers that someone could imply that would explain if we're neutrally playing a minor chord, someone will emerge and say, and like with the notes that they're playing will say, this is actually the re, the two of a scale. And that will inform us as to what, you know, chords or progressions are at play if the A minor is considered a two. That those aren't rules per se, but like those are the types of things where, so more than anything, if we were to start, I mean, honestly, like in practice, one of us just starts fiddling around and the others join and then 35 minutes go by. But if we were to, if we were
boil
to
it down.
Yeah. But if we were to say like, all right, let's do an A minor jam to start and it's the six. Or it's the two. So it might be a little easier.
So then you shift things around that way and transpose, so to speak. But is there a particular minor? All right, so we're on this theory thing. So I just have one question. We're not going to go down deep down the theory road. I can't really do that, but I can sort of follow it. But is there particular minor chords that speak to you in certain ways for certain songs? Like, is there like just a sadder minor chord, or is it just about what the key, what key you're playing? Like, is B minor more sad than an A minor? Is it just the key that you're playing at?
Well, if they're the both on the same like point of the scale, like if we're talking about a two, like that do re, the minor re,
I mean,
again, this is utterly subjective. It's like what's that Spinal Tap quote? It's like it's in D minor, the saddest of all keys. Or is that what it is?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, I see, like, I'll follow some Instagram, you know, music theory pages, and it'll explain what you're saying, like, where, you know, E major is, like, grounded and hopeful, whereas E flat major is uplifting and triumphant. I think that comes down to, like, a gut feeling. I will say that, you know, across the scale, a minor two does sound different than a minor six in the notes of the scale, or a one chord, that home bass chord sounds very different than the major four chord, which is like that Jerry Garcia kind of floaty deal. So each chord as it relates to where it lives in the scale has its own character.
Interesting.
And it's fun to play with those emotions. But then at the same time, you could totally do juxtaposition and have, especially as like a lyricist or as, you know, writing the vocal melodies, I could sing purposefully happy over a minor sad, you know, chord. So there aren't rules, but it is helpful to understand the relationship so you can like play what you're feeling.
Yeah, I mean, there are no hard, fast rules. That's what makes music so interesting. It's so incredibly subjective depending on the nature of the human that's playing it. I've talked to artists where he's like, I love just singing really happy shit over super sad chords and vice versa.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it have some staying power when, especially with the advent of Spotify and how our world works, like you have so much music coming at you all the time. Mm. If we all played by the rules, it would all blend together. It's when the rules get broken is when it's like, ooh, my ear is not used to that in Western music. What was that transition? What's that chord change?
Yeah. Well, it's the individuality of the human experience, and not sound too grandiose, but in effect, that essentially means to me, it's just why music is fucking awesome, because it's created by individuals with different experience, different skill levels, different perspectives. And at unique moments in their life when they want to express things that perhaps they haven't expressed before, or they want to express things in a different way than they've done before.
And that's exactly it. And it's like, I think what's really interesting that you are aware of is like, it's that musician at that point in their life today.
Exactly.
You know, because like you could give it a week, give it a year, give it a 10 years. I look back on some of my old lyrics and I was like, huh, I don't really feel that way anymore. But I did in my heart of hearts, and that's still authentic. And, you know, but it's funny how even, you know, we were talking about how fans will take a song that we wrote in a different way. Like I look at some of our old stuff. I'm like, man, I take a totally different lesson from that than I was intending.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting too. Holy shit. That you can actually reinterpret your own songs as to like how you're feeling now.
That's why I get it, man. I totally get it. I'm like, wow, I see what the speaker is trying to say. I don't necessarily agree with that anymore, but I did. And that's why, I mean, unless you're playing a character for a song, like you got to speak with what's true. And
yeah,
I know it was, even if like my views change over time. So it's still authentic. It's still real. And hopefully why people, you know, give us the time of day to listen. And that's like this new album, Day and Time. That's what this is about, right?
Yeah,
like, this was recorded on that day and time, and now it's already yesterday. You know, it's already recorded. It's done. We wrote those songs. We recorded them, and we're on to our, and life moves on, and now we're in different stages. There are like more children in our lives than there were when we were recording this. Like it's unbelievable. So
who else has kids now?
So Jeremy just welcomed his second.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And Ben has one as well. So there are five kids now, which is unbelievable. It's not a surprise that if I look on my lyrics 10, 15 years ago or 12 years ago, that they don't ring as true as they used to. Some of them do. Most of them do.
Yeah, I mean,
but like even just like I'm getting into the nitty gritty, like that one line, I'm like, I think I've lived and learned a little on that one, but
right. But you're not judging yourself for saying that at that moment. You're kind of just stepping back and observing it and going, I'm just different now, or are you?
Well, yeah. I mean, both things
depends.
Are true.
Yeah.
That's how I felt. This is how I feel. They're both true.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, you guys have your own flock of your own now. That's amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty.
Jeremy's got a new one.
Yeah. New. Very, very new.
Well, pass on my congratulations. That's wonderful.
Yes. Yes, I will. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that's amazing stuff. So growing up, where'd you grow up, Greg?
I grew up in Long Island, New York.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, that checks out. The little bit of a remaining New York accent there.
Not too bad.
There are kind of regional differences. Like, you know, I grew up in California. I don't necessarily talk like I'm in high school still, but
yeah,
you know, there's a thing. There's a thing going on with me. I'm aware.
I think I escaped Long Island without the Long Island accent that I hear in my friends and family, and you know, nothing against it. It's just fun.
Was that like, little scrambled Greg running around when you were a kid? Your parents were together.
Yes. My folks are still together. They retired.
Where in Long Island?
Port Washington, which is like 40 minutes from Manhattan. North Shore.
North Shore. Okay.
Great.
I lived in New York for 11 years in the city.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
in the city?
I did grad work at NYU.
Cool.
After I went to University of California at Santa Barbara and then lived for a year in Italy when I was younger. 2 years in Italy when I was younger. So, yeah.
Man. Uh-huh. You've been traveling, man.
I have. I've been all around, man. Three biggest cities in the country. I've lived in LA, New York, and Chicago. So
how do you like Chicago?
It's great. I've lived here for like 23 years. I mean, you know, it depends what time of the year you're asking me. Today's an absolutely beautiful, gorgeous spring day, crisp, incredible blue sky, and the flowers are in peak bloom.
Yeah.
So ask me, like, we'll come back and we'll chat in January, and I'll just go, this place is fucking horrible.
When it's cold in the kitchen?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not just like the temperature, but it's just the grayness. And now but it makes you super appreciate the greenness, you know?
Totally.
And I love snow and it just barely snows anymore. But Chicago, great, amazing music environment. Musical scene here is incredible. I live in a place that's like a 10-minute drive to 7 different venues that nationally touring artists make a stop of.
Yeah, so that's such a luxury,
fucking amazing.
Man.
Yeah. I don't know many other cities where I could claim that.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, there's some, nationally touring acts is the kicker.
Like, yeah.
I found that there's certain little hideaway, smaller cities, not like where there's tons of music at bars and clubs and a few bigger rooms, but like it's a lot of local, a lot of, you know, within that state.
Which is great too.
Which
you know?
Is fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Baltimore with all my heart, but there's not like a ton of places to see music, especially yeah. for those bigger acts.
Uh-huh. Yeah, here but, I've got the Riv, the Aragon, Empty Bottle, Lincoln Hall, Shuba's, Dahlia Hall, and not to mention Chicago Theater, Auditorium Theater that are in the Loop. Just and I'm probably leaving one out,
the
so I apologize.
Shed,
and the Salt
Chicago?
Shed, yeah, that's a fairly new
I
one.
I mean, we've played a number of places in Chicago too. Like I know our friends play Martyrs, the smaller spot, and
Martyrs. Yeah, it's kind of like a bar stage situation.
Abbey Bar, is that a place? I don't know. But again, not the best band historian. Jeremy would have been able to rattle off the year and venue of every single place we played in Chicago. But Chicago's been awesome to us, man. Like we've always been just utterly blown away by the support.
Yeah. Midwest is always a good run for you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. And Chicago's like that stronghold that
I'm so sorry I missed when you were here in December. I think it was December at Park West. Park West is another one.
Oh, yeah. That place is great.
Yeah.
That place is cool.
I mean, really cool, fun, unique venue with those. It's sort of like that old school kind of like nightclubby. There's those, I don't know if you saw, there's those booths in the background.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The green room's above that.
What's that?
The green room's in the back above that. So it's.
Oh, it is.
Cool,
oh, okay.
Pretty
I haven't
cool
been
view
back to
of
that
everything.
One. Oh, cool. So New York, growing up in New York, obviously you did really well in school. Like what was kind of your musical background? How'd you come into this?
Well, to clarify, I did really well in school up until I was about 16. And then I had some other interests kind of pull me away from it.
Interesting. But, which ones were those?
But just, you know, usual junior in high school.
The usual suspects.
Suspects. But I mean, yeah, I played a lot of sports. I did not get into jam music until I went to college and met Jeremy. I met Jeremy on the first day of college.
Oh, we really? Started, where'd you guys
we
go?
We went to University of Maryland.
Okay. That checks out.
Yep. And,
when'd you move to Baltimore? Is that when you moved to Baltimore? So your family's not from there.
Right. So the band lives in Baltimore. My folks, lived in New York and then retired to Florida.
Okay.
Which
is a requirement of all Long Island Jews.
Yeah, I think it's in the Torah that you must go to Boca.
I missed that. That was my Torah portion for my bar mitzvah.
Yeah, exactly. But in New York, I wasn't into that. I mean, I listened to like the radio, like the popular music. My dad was very much into classic rock. And similarly with New York Jews, you got to love Billy Joel, Elton John, Stevie Wonder, Sting, like those types of acts.
Mm-hmm.
My dad loved the Allman Brothers. Rest in peace, Dickie Betts.
Yeah. Rest in peace, man.
You know, so my musical bug was with musical theater. I was in plays and musicals from the age of 5 to 17. So
nice.
With that also eventually came choirs, choruses, all those types of singing things. Thus my comfortability performing as Mr. Rome in Saturnalia. I had been on stage since I can remember. So I'd been singing for a long time. I kind of started to teach myself guitar a little bit. My neighbor was very good at guitar and really funny. So we hung out a bunch and played guitar right before college. So when I met Jeremy, I had an acoustic guitar in my hand that I'd been playing for like 6 months or so. But I had been singing since I was 5 years old. And Jeremy was kind of the opposite. He'd been playing guitar for 12 years.
Yeah.
He is not one to like grab the mic and MC a wedding. You know, he's much more of the you know,
he's that guy that shreds, but doesn't sing that much.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we just were a perfect pair and started jamming immediately, literally within, you know, an hour of college. We were in the dorm room writing music together.
First song you guys played?
Oh,
I know that's a fair question. Fuck it. You can move on.
He probably taught me Farmhouse, maybe.
Oh, nice.
And I like did not listen to Fish at all.
I think they played that last night, dude, at the Sphere.
I know, with Northern Lights in the Sphere. I live on the road, and I'm just one of those guys that like I like going to shows, but like it's not my like I don't know. I just my priorities have shifted with kids and stuff, so
absolutely.
I very rarely like realize it's Saturday night at home because like I'm just out all
right,
the time.
Like,
I like just rest at home, but Fish at the Sphere is like the first FOMO I felt.
Oh my
like,
god!
Since
dude.
My kids were born, like,
oh my god!
It really like it hit me like a ton of bricks. I had a feeling it was
hitting
coming when
everybody
people
hard that's not there.
Yeah, I have not felt that. I've missed fish in various capacities since having kids, but this one is like, I can't go to Mont Green. I can't, you know, that doesn't really, I already did that. You know, I went to fish festivals and
yeah,
had an absolute blast, seen them 50 times, you know, but yeah, Sphere is hitting for sure. It'll pass. It's okay.
Yeah, I know. I'm just I'm trying to say home to myself, I'm texting other people. I'm focusing on texting fans that are fish fans that are not there so that we can kind of commiserate a little bit.
Yeah, it's but something else.
It's definitely something to see. When you look at Larry, we're going to get back to Jeremy and you guys jamming out to Farmhouse in the Dorm, but since you brought it up, it's happening now. When you look at, you've looked at videos of the Sphere. When you see that, what comes to mind in terms of performance, and how does that feel from your perspective, kind of looking at what goes on there, the visuals that everyone experiencing, the utter uniqueness and the way that that sort of performance is set apart, from just playing at your local 2000 seat venue with your own light rig? What feelings come up for you as a performer when you see that, what that kind of one-off possibility could be? And does it work for you, I guess, would be also something to look at.
If you're asking if I would play the Sphere, I think you know the answer. But the
I did not ask that because I knew the answer.
The first thing I thought of, besides like just taking it in as a fan, mm-hmm. was, wow, this must be so cool for the band, because normally the light show's behind them. So that amazing Chris Kuroda touch, the production, they don't mm-hmm. really get to see. You see the beat, like from my experience, you see the beams that shoot out toward the crowd, but you don't see the painting. You see the splatter, you know?
Interesting.
With the Sphere, they must be equally blown away while they're playing. I wonder if it's got to be a marriage between distracting and invigorating, you know, inspiring. Mm-hmm. But I can imagine, I think when I was watching, I think I saw like Mike looking up and I was like, oh my God, I think this would be, is probably so cool for them and so different for them. And that makes, especially with it being the inaugural run, like it's fresh for everyone, including the guys.
Yeah.
You know, like they've played Madison Square Garden, I don't know how many times. So yes, they love it there, but they also are used to it. The novelty, I assume, would fade a little. But like, I remember my first time playing Red Rocks, it's a similar thing where I, you know, the view from the stage to the crowd is breathtaking.
It is.
You know, whereas most of the time, the best view is reserved for the fans, as it should be. So I do think it would create an inspiring and possibly distracting element to performing. But there's also, it's that inaugural thing that's happening. It's that fresh, like, I mean, they're the first band since, you know, besides U2 to even play there. Like, what's this going to look like in 10 years? Is it still going to be an exodus? And I do think it will be, because what you can do there is just unlike anything they can pull off, even at the best arena in the world, you know?
Yeah. 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 It's definitely going to be a one-off kind of thing. I mean, yeah. Is this going to be kind of the destination forever? I mean, at $1 billion plus, it's in all likelihood that there may or may not be other spheres anywhere. I haven't scratched that deep to see what the thinking is and kind of where that's going to be. I don't really know at all, but yeah, incredibly unique experience. And it's new to everybody, which is an interesting point.
I'm curious. I mean, Fish is on another level, but everyone knows like they close out the summer at Dick's usually in Colorado. And that's kind of like they do pull out a lot of stops for that.
Yeah.
The Garden, New Year's, those types of things are always like extra special shows. At least, you know, they're attempted to be, whether it's through set list or, you know, gags or what have you. This Sphere thing might be competing with all of those if you have to pick one, right? Like that, it's almost competing with itself. But do you catch Fish at Dick's, or do you just go to the Sphere in Vegas? You might have to go to the Sphere in Vegas, you know, like it depends. But then there's also, you know, when I was also excited to see that they did have lights. I wasn't sure if they would have a single light on stage.
Oh, yeah, they had those little like four standard lights.
Yeah, I saw those, and that helps. Because I don't think Kuroda's running the Sphere stuff. I think they have a different creative director.
I thought about that, actually. When they showed a view from the performer's perspective, you can see the lights that are projecting from up top. I'm like, who's running this, and what did that look like?
It's so complex, right? Yeah, but I know Trey was heavily involved with the creative director at the Sphere, mm-hmm. or whoever they brought in to handle this you know, enormous task. But man, yeah, it's really exciting. And I just, my first thought when they were pouring all this money into it was like, how long is this going to be mind blowing? And so far it seems like a long time.
Yeah,
you know, because technology moves so quickly.
Mind-blowing, I think it becomes, it does not like become less mind-blowing as time goes on. Your mind just continues to get blown.
Well, but think about your, you know, the first time you put on 3D glasses and then you make your way towards the VR and
Vision Pro. I recently demoed the Apple Vision Pro.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's amazing. When I took my son out spring break in LA just a couple weeks ago, he finagled that and we had to go to the Third Street Promenade in Santa Monica, the Apple Store. He's like, Dad, we got to do the Vision Pro. It was fucking amazing. That was mind-blowing. That was mind-blowing. Yeah.
But can you see in 20 years being like, man, remember when we thought those glasses were mind-blowing? Now I just like, you know.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, but that's what sci-fi writers do, 100%.
Yeah,
and that's
exactly.
What just like, yeah, it's interesting, man. But think about where we need to be in 20 years for put on a Vision Pro or any kind of VR apparatus. And then where do we have to be for this not to be mind-blowing? Holy shit.
Yeah. It's an incredible time to be alive.
And is it a bad place? But and I keep looking at the sphere and I'm thinking, okay, well, this is the future. We're right at the very beginning of the VR music experience.
Yeah.
And is that a good thing?
It looked pretty good to me.
Well, it's visually stimulating, yes. But then I love the authenticity of music. I love coming to a pigeon show and seeing four guys up there just fucking rock the shit. And yes, it's additive, but are we looking at the future? We're looking at the future of shows at the Sphere.
Yeah. It feels a little black and white, you know, like, excuse me, it's going to be both. You're going to have that special destination thing, but like Fish tried and true or any band, especially in our jam world, is all about the natural energy, the fact that, you know, four or five musicians can, you know, close their eyes and make some magic happen that we all get to be a part of. I'd be more concerned if and when like you can have a VR experience at the Sphere at home. That's a future that I'd be a little concerned
Quest,
with as a performer.
Go to your local Apple store, dude, and try the Vision Quest. Sign up for a half an hour demo.
Oh man, I might have to. That part blew me away. I could see that happening and that being ultimately a detriment. Kind of like how streaming movies at home has threatened the movie theater experience. I can imagine as a live performer, I know I like really feed off the crowd. So
no question. It's always better to be at a show, but look, like streaming was a boon for bands. It was a boon for you guys during the pandemic. And I think it's additive.
Yeah,
and I think that
truly,
if you're a music fan, I would rather go to your show, but if I can stream your show, you know, and I want to see Pigeons, then it's fantastic and make me pay for it.
I think the key is what we're circling around is like they need to coexist. They can't usurp, you know, and I think they always will, because as great as it is to, you know, watch a game winning shot of a basketball game on your couch with your friends, there is nothing like being in Madison Square Garden when the ball goes through the net.
Absolutely, you know? But it's a really nice close second to have all your buddies around and have access to easy access to the bathroom and beers.
Yeah.
And you do get the kind of exciting feeling. It's a very, very, all right, I won't put two varies in there, but I'll say it's a nice close second. It's as good of a second as you can get. Right.
Especially if you can't make it.
Yeah, exactly. First of all, there's only 17,000 people can fit in the Sphere, however many it is. Right. So that's also just a finite amount. That's a hard, fast number. Right.
Yeah.
So what if I can put on my Vision Quest, or my Vision Pro at home for a special experience and watch the show on my Vision Pro if I can't be there? That would be actually
fucking
cool.
I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm in for that.
Yeah.
I just,
I'm not disputing
you wouldn't be,
Greg. I'm just like throwing that out there.
Yeah, I would just be concerned if that trend included like most concerts in 20 years, like, you know, just less and less in-person stuff, which I truly don't foresee happening.
No,
because
no.
there's something, that intangible energy that is so addictive that, you know, and I truly believe like it can improve, you know, not more than, than needing to be stated, but like I think that it can really, you can take the energy that you get at a show and go out in the world and spread it in a really positive way.
That's the trickle down, sort of. Like the trickle down, I just kind of see like, okay, this is a one, the sphere is a one-off, right? Maybe it'll be another sphere somewhere. I've said that before. But what are the takeaways? The takeaways are that the energy is just incredible at a fucking live show, you know? Yeah. And like, you're going to do it at the 8x11. What's it called? The 8x10?
8x10.
8x10 in Baltimore. Or you're going to do it at the Sphere in Vegas. You know, I think you walk away feeling kind of maybe more blown away from a visual standpoint, but that remains to be seen. I'll make that determination when I go to a show at the Sphere afterwards, how I feel. But goddamn, I feel great at a fucking pigeon show at the Riv, man.
Ah, appreciate it.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. It's a lot cheaper too.
Yeah, right. It's the energy. It's the fucking energy. All right. So you and Jeremy are playing Farmhouse back in your dorm, and interesting musical theater, man. Got a high school musical thing going on. What kind of sports did you play?
I played soccer my whole life, or my whole adolescence, you know, 5 to 17, I was playing soccer. And then, just for fun, I mean, I played basketball for a while, and that was probably the one I played on the side for fun the most. I played lacrosse, I played baseball early on. I mean, I kind of did it all.
Mm-hmm.
But soccer was my bread and butter, and I truly use principles of soccer in my life and on stage all the time.
Oh, really?
You know, it's all about spacing and being connected as a group. It's not an individual sport. You have to create space for others.
It's the beautiful game.
I keep that in mind when, you know, as the front man, there's portions of times where I'm supposed to be the front man. I'm supposed to be up in the front, getting the crowd ready.
Yeah.
And then other times, if someone's taking a solo or is shining in a particular moment, it's not my job to upstage them. It's my job to sit back and give them room to shine. So, I do draw parallels to sports in a lot of ways when I'm on stage. So like a teamwork kind of thing.
I mean, it's team play, right? When you think about team play, you don't immediately think about a symphony orchestra. Things people think about a basketball team or a soccer team.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, spatially, I think about it. Teamwork, I think about it. Hard work, you know, motivation, getting through highs and lows together. And then also, yeah, it totally trickles into my lyrics and stuff. Like in Yo Soy Fiesta, there's this break where I'm a soccer announcer that leads you to a goal. Right. And there's a... There's some other lyric about making it rain in regards to basketball. Like, what is it? I can't even think of my own lyrics. It's something about, I'm a coach on the sideline. Whoever is like an actual fan of ours listening to this would be like, dude, it's this song this lyric. Like,
this ding dong singing the songs up there. Can't even remember them.
I'm your player coach with a cold drive.
No judgment here, dude.
That's what it is.
More fascinating for me that you can't like remember it off the pull it up. But if it was in the song, you'd remember it.
Draining buckets without misfire. I'm your player coach with a cold drive. That's what it is. That's some basketball. But yeah, it all trickles in there. I love watching sports at home.
Yeah, yeah. I come from that kind of background too. I mean, I started hanging out with the cool kids playing music in high school, but I was an athlete 100,000% early on. Yeah. My grandfather was actually a professional baseball player in the Pacific Coast League in the 1920s, thirties and early 40s. Yeah. He was a pretty well-known player for the San Francisco Seals, Hollywood Stars, a couple other teams on the Pacific Coast League before the major leagues moved out to
LA
in 1955 with the Dodgers.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, really cool.
That's
stuff.
So
I have
cool.
some amazing memorabilia. I have like game played balls. I have game played bats.
You know,
Once you're a player and have a brand of your signature at Louisville Slugger, you can, if you're a blood relative, you can write them a letter showing proof and they'll send you a model of what that bat was for that one player.
Oh, cool.
That was a really cool thing. So, you know, I spent way more time in athletics, but then I started playing guitar and stuff. So I relate to that. That there's a distinct duality, and so there's a kindred brotherhood of those that are athletes and musicians.
Yeah, it was interesting because I got to hang with the theater kids who were incredibly creative and fun and silly, and then the athletes who were incredibly hardworking and driven, and you know, it was kind of fun to try to be a chameleon bouncing around. That's an awfully romantic way of looking back on it, being like, I don't know where I fit, but I'm going to just try all these different hats.
Okay, you make it sound easy, but sometimes there was a lot of battle like going on in my head also. But what did that look like for you? So when you met Jeremy, were you like, wow, this is fun. I mean, you guys were doing it like for fucking fun and stuff, but when did that kind of become, how did that move along? Tell me about sort of the relationship and both from a personal standpoint as well as from a musical standpoint.
Well, I mean, as cheesy as it is, we still do it for fun, like genuinely. Oh, I mean,
not
I have,
cheesy at all, dude.
I have, you know, there's more pressure to have it be economically sound with children and whatnot, yeah. You know, so it is a profession.
Yeah, it is a means to an end at this point.
At this point, but it always has been like this ride. And I mean, we did it for fun when we met, just playing in the dorm. And then like we would all go out as a group and then come back and play for our friends and like joking and laughing. Mm. I was not very good. I mean, I was still not great at guitar, but I was really not wonderful when I started. So Jeremy used to do these open mic nights where it would be just him, the Jeremy Schoen experience. Mm-hmm. And then for a 45 minute set, but the last 15 minutes I would jump on, bring my clunky guitar and we would play No Woman, No Farmhouse mashup.
Oh Jesus. So this is where it comes from. Okay. I had that on my list of questions.
Yeah. So we'd started doing mashups like that. We did, speaking of Sting, we did the Every Breath You Take Sting and the Puff Daddy version, which is, you know, we'll just leave it at that. It was pre-Diddy. Yeah, we would do these silly songs and then some of our like kind of dorm room classics that we started to write originals on. And one of the earliest songs that we still play is Indiglo. That was probably like our fourth song. And it's taken us, we were always writing. It's taken us so many years to like get all of the quote unquote like worthy older songs recorded. And I think with Day and Time, this new record, it's the first time that there's nothing from those, you know, previous years. Like it's all, written, you know, at least after 2020 and kind of like more representative of our current songwriting style as an entire group than ever before.
Had you cleared the queue on that, or are there still some songs that are hanging out there that haven't made to vinyl, or was it something that, we just don't want to put those on. We want to go 100% fresh on this. And by that, just to clarify for listeners, we're talking about, there's just not older songs that you play, like on, even on Perspective, there was and a couple other ones that you guys have been playing for a while.
Was Indiglo on that too? Maybe
I can stand up and look. I can't remember.
It is behind you. But
it's interesting to note that that's kind of a new direction.
It's kind of all of the above. You know, like we did clear the queue a good amount. There's so many other songs that aren't on the albums from the early years, but also like we've been like writing more voraciously lately, and like we just, there's something similar to that, like, you know, first experience at the Sphere, like it's the news material is exciting for the band and the fans, I think, just because, you know, it's fresh and novel. And I mean, it was a combination of that, and again, like with the name, like Day and Time, this is our this is a snapshot of us right when we recorded it, like not, you know, that plus some old baggage. It's just us, you know, right now.
Well, how does that, so Day and Time, but, and I don't mean to challenge you on this, but how does that differ from a prior album apart from the songs? Cause you're always just like, just to boil it down, we're always like in the moment writing the songs, playing it. But is there something specifically special about this Day and Time concept?
I mean, just that, again, like this is one of the first, I think the first time that it's all within the same time frame of Genesis, Performance, Laying It Down. And we were able to like tap a number of our close friends to join us, like Smiley from Main Squeeze is on the title track. We have Joey Porter from the Motet, AC from Talk is on it, both on keys. A great player named Chalk Dinosaur added some crazy stuff on this song, Skinner.
You got a cat from the Main Squeeze.
Smiley, yeah, he's incredible. Okay, they're keyboardist, yeah.
I know Corey. Is it Corey? Yeah, I had him on the show. He lived in L.A.
Oh, cool. He's incredible, man.
Oh, my God, what a great story, too. Wow. Out of Indianapolis, such a cool cat.
Yeah, we played with them at their, like, old, you know, haunt.
I got a standing, I hope it's still a standing invitation to come out to their studio that overlooks the valley in LA when they're playing. So if you're, if you're listening,
awesome.
Man, I haven't forgotten. I've yet to cash in on that. So I want to come visit you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
I mean, overall, I'm super proud of the album, but like, as soon as we're done recording, we're writing the next one, you know, like it's just, we're just constantly, it's more fun for us to just be working on something.
Just continue
fresh.
To just be, just do the thing that you're doing in terms of, so moving along with Jeremy. So we've got that dialogue in the background always, and then we sort of offshoot into different places. Cause you're such an interesting human, Greg. Your technique is very unique to me and very just fun. I love, and I love the new album. I think the new album really stands, and I've listened to the whole thing. It really kind of stands alone in that it's a really great capsule of just the beautiful recorded studio funkiness work that you guys do. And I just want to say, I love the guests that you have, and there's a truly unique feel, and you guys do such a great job in the studio. I just want to put that out there. I really love what you guys do.
Thank you so much, man.
Yeah. I mean, jam bands can just kind of be like, you know, we're going to put it out there. We're going to just put it up on Nugs and everyone's going to come to our shows. But it's beautiful what you've done with this one. It's really great. And there's some fucking bangers, and I've already got a couple favorites. So well done, man. But
thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. You have a really unique rhythm playing. You guys are super funky and you're also rock. When did you kind of come into that? Was there a moment, or was that a long evolution for you to sort of come into that style of playing?
You know, I truly think it's all been pretty natural. I did not like the funk that I knew before Jeremy was pretty much Stevie Wonder and like Earth, Wind & Fire radio hits and things like that. I didn't really get into it too much, but after being in the jam scene for 15 plus years, you know, learning, you know, getting used to bands like Lettuce and New Master Sounds and, you know, all the amazing funk acts that now Corey Wong and like all these amazing acts, it just seeps in. But I mean, we're not, you know, when you start a band, I think it's common to like cover bands that you like to try to, you know, have those styles sink in and see what comes out of that, you know, combination. Mm-hmm. Nowadays we're just trying to write like ourselves, know, and that a lot of it's been funk, but I also think like even on this album, there's a lot more, dynamics. So it's not just like, you know, upbeat, high energy funk songs. There's also like chiller, you know, groovy, textured, more like maybe sonically rich sections, more valleys to that lead up to a big peak, as opposed to, you know, more energetic stuff that we're used to. So a song like Beneath the Surface is like way more textural and floaty and cool, compared to, I mean, there's still funk songs for sure. Like The Town, the first song on the album, is a total dance funk track. But I don't know. I in terms of my playing, I just try to, you know, do what feels right, work hard in the background. And then like, I don't know, there's something we always loved high energy psychedelic funk. Like that's just what we like. And what, you know, there's bands and that I've seen in the crowd and watched them build funky peaks to ecstasy and like, you know, totally loved that feeling, you know, figurative ecstasy.
Literal sometimes.
Well, you know, just figurative ecstasy. But no, no matter what I'm watching or you know, it could even, like I said, even I draw parallels from sports. And you know, I just was listening to a podcast recently. A guy said a phrase that really stuck with me, and within a couple of days, I had written a song around the idea. I'm just kind of like, oh, most musicians are just like a sponge to all of it, whether it's musical or, you know, lyrical, and try not to overthink it. Just try to let it fly out, and, you know, it comes out funky in our case.
I feel you on that, on the ups and downs, on the differences in amplitude, in the peaks and valleys, in funk versus rock. I mean, make no mistake. I mean, pigeons is going to, you're going to want to move your feet. You're going to want to bang your head sometimes. And I do love that variety quite a bit. And you guys really do that well, not only on the, in the studio album, but in a live setting as well.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think one of our things is like, we're all about, you know, we're all about that big peak at the end of a moment or, mm-hmm. or, you know, that high energy explosion.
Yeah.
But even if we settle into a nice groove or a valley or a different genre, whether it's rock or reggae or like an islandy kind of thing, no matter what the pace is, you are going to be able to dance to it, you know, and that's the danceability yeah. is so important to us. In terms of just, you know, energy transfer and what we're kind of hoping to provide at our shows is, even if it's a slow tempo trip hop, you're still going to like maybe catch a little lag in your neck and some stank face, you know, but you're still grooving. It doesn't all have to be 120 BPMs and a funk peak. No matter what, you're going to be dancing. I think that's largely credited to our drummer Gator, who you met, and Ben, our bassist, like just holding down the grooves, whether we're being light and feathery or, you know, balls to the wall.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't talked about just the overall musicianship of your band as players together, as individuals. Is just, it's staggering, dude. I fucking love it. Give me your take on what's the current status of the jam band scene, and how's that changed over the years from your perspective?
You know, I think while tastes are adjusting as different bands kind of emerge, the big thing about it that I think is like always the case is the open-mindedness that, like, you know, I feel like, and maybe I'm mischaracterizing the mainstream, but people might like one genre the most, and that's gonna, you know, pretty much be the majority of their listening. Like if someone's into rap, they're gonna listen primarily to hip hop. You know, if someone's into rock, they're gonna listen to metal or rock. Whereas I think fans who love, you know, jam music or Phish also love funk, also love bluegrass, also love mm-hmm. hip hop. So I think when, you know, some of these like juggernauts start to emerge, like Goose or Billy Strings or what have you, I think it's not so much saying that those types of genres are leading the charge. I think it's just speaking to people, and it's not so much about genre as it is like, you know, this audience just wants to be moved one way or the other, and that's what's resonating.
Interesting. Yeah. So is what you're saying indicate that jam band is more of an umbrella term, because there are different silos within jam bands that could indicate, like, if someone came up to you and said, okay, I like hip hop, I like this, I like these bands, I like this band, you're like, listen to that. I mean, you're always going to say listen to Pigeons, but you know what I mean? Like different jam bands can represent different musical tastes. I found that to be the case.
Well, I don't tell everyone to listen to Pigeons, for what it's worth. they can figure it out on their own if they want. Yes, I mean,
you only want organic fans. You're not there because you have to be.
I thought about this yesterday, actually, because there's this one guy who sends me like, hey, have you ever heard of this band? And I'm always excited to be like, oh yeah, I know them. Do you know them? They're like, oh, who's that? But I was thinking, like, it's nice to, you know, jam bands or jam fans know so many different types of bands that if someone says, hey, what should I listen to, you can kind of just be like, well, what are you looking for? Because like, I'm not just gonna mm-hmm. say like, oh, my favorite band is, you know, or like, I love Taylor Swift, so you should check out her new album.
Yeah.
It could be more like, yeah, like, are you, what kind of mood are you in right
choose
now,
choose your adventure.
Exactly. So I think, you know, I think the state of the jam scene is incredibly strong. I think bands like Goose and Billy String only lift up everyone. Mm-hmm. I think the, you know, the sea level rises with the biggest boat.
The rising tide lifts all ships.
That was much better than what I said.
Well, and my I don't even think I'm getting the wording together. And you know what?
But you were closer.
The funny thing is that I just, in that Gator interview, we also talked about that in terms of the jam band world, because it was like right when you guys were touring with Goose, and then over the pandemic, they were going bonkers. And we were like, well, fuck, you know, it just rises. Well,
I have always felt that way. Like, even I remember when Wolfpack announced that they were playing the Garden, some folks were like a little like, oh, I wish I could, like a little jealous. And I'm like, this is amazing news. Like a yeah. funk band is playing Madison Square Garden. This right. is incredible. Like, you know, for the same way. And I'm pretty bullish on modern music, like mainstream music, when, you know, as soon as Mark Ronson started getting his hands on the funk tracks that became number one hits, like when, as soon as like Uptown Funk started becoming, you know, the number one song, I was like, oh, this bodes very well for everybody. Cause like, I find very instrument based, funky, you know, I heard a guitar, you know,
if you listen really carefully.
Yeah. Like the new Justin Timberlake album is fantastic. And I do hear guitars. You really have to listen carefully, but.
Well, it's like Aaron Dessner of The National producing two Taylor Swift albums. I was like, okay, I'm on board for those.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. And yeah, so I'm very excited about all the music that's coming out. I think the coolest part with the internet and Spotify and all that is that we all get to see it in real time. You know, I thought like when Silk Sonic came out, it was like all of a sudden this retro reemergence of kind of Motown swag that I was like, oh, this is fantastic. This sounds like something that I was like, man, I wish I was around when this was going on, but it is right now, you know? And then you have like your Krungbins of the world who are stretching our palate in one direction. Oh, and then, you know, they're great. And that's like, and if you get into that because of Spotify, you find all these other artists who are doing something similar in that.
What is this, Glass Beads? Wow. Glass
Beads? I don't know. I don't know them.
Yeah.
Cool. I know there's one I can't pronounce. It's like Le Imperatrice or something like that. It's blowing up. Do you know Parcels?
Glass Beams. Check them out, dude. It's like little masks.
Got it. Cool. Will do.
Yeah. I don't know that much about them, but they're definitely on my radar. There's so many incredible either instrumental bands that are just incorporating all these different global music influences. I saw this incredible jam band from Morocco at South by Meteor Airlines. Wow, they were really great. So many different things. Yeah, it's kind of a choose your adventure. And another thing that you talked about was that in the modern music world, to bring things back that might seem retro, but really it's that. So you talked about Silk Sonic, right? Who that was, Anderson .Paak and Bruno Mars.
Yep.
It's that, and I always reflect on this. I'm 60 years old. I grew up listening to classic rock. I don't want to listen. I'll go back once in a while and listen to like a couple Zeppelin tunes. But I get off when guys your age are playing fucking classic rock covers or any other covers, but also incorporating that into what your vibe is. Because what I'm talking about is not necessarily needing the nostalgia of going back and listening to Livin' Lovin' Maid for the 1 billionth time, but it's that vibe that just gets into your soul. It's that musical soul vibe. And I want real live human beings today that are influenced by the things that I like. And I want to listen to what people are doing today. Now, what is this happening now? You know, I want to pick up the day and time that's, you know, a day and time that's influenced by you who has some of these similar musical touch points. And that, I think that's what's important.
You know, it's funny you say day and time too, because that track, that came out of, I think, the initial idea that Jeremy wrote the bulk of musically. We were playing, we do a lot of themes for different holidays and whatnot, or we used to a lot more, but, you know, always Halloween and stuff like that. And around the Super Bowl in 2020, we were asked to play a stream before the Super Bowl at Brooklyn Bowl in New York. And we did the theme, the Super Bowl Halftime Hall of Fame, which was within our songs, we played covers or mashups or new ideas of anyone who has headlined the halftime show at the Super Bowl.
I swear, I think I've listened to that song, but your theme shows are just absolutely amazing. But yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it. It's really fun.
Come on.
We didn't go to music school, so that's kind of like our school is when we inhabit these other bands. But when we were working on that material, you know, there's a lot of amazing acts who have played the Super Bowl. And so we were learning, you know, some Rolling Stones, some Aerosmith, some Bruce Springsteen, some, you know, Bruno Mars. Like we were learning all these different acts that we hadn't had a reason to like dig too far deep into. So we were kind of on this classic rock kick, and Jeremy came up with the core of Day and Time after learning the ways of those types of bands. So that track totally has influence from like crash course through classic rock, and then let's put our modern spin on it. And then like life goes on and you revisit it, and then I sing on it, and it's, and I didn't know that. So like I'm now singing in my own way that I would approach this music, not knowing that there's like I thankfully was not aware that Jeremy was thinking about, you know, whether it was the Stones or Aerosmith or Bruce, like they all have very specific melodic styles, singing styles. Like, I don't think I sound like Mick Jagger on any of this, you know, but I just let it speak to me and let my influence kind of tap into it. So I don't know. It's I totally know what you mean. And I think what we're realizing more than ever, including in the modern music world, is just like fusion. Like the lines are just blurry now. You know, it is unclear. Like Beyonce is doing country music, but there's also some like drops in it that are hip hoppy. You know, there's some swaggy breakdowns.
Yeah,
and like
there's so many influences, but you can't get away from who you really are.
Right. Yeah.
I think, for good reason, and your fans love that.
So I guess what I'm kind of like thinking about is how the jam scene like is very, you know, it's not necessarily genre specific. Like this album we put out has funk, rock, island, you know, dance, electronic, you know, what have you, down tempo stuff. And similarly, now I'm seeing more and more in the pop world that the lines are getting blurred in a really awesome way. So I feel great about both scenes. I think music's crashing right now.
Absolutely. I would agree. Okay. You've been so generous with your time, Greg. Thanks so much for hanging in. I mean, this has been an amazing conversation. A couple things I want to run down with you. So Dome Fest, not doing it this year. That's your annual fan camp out festival. You do like really cool workshops, because I went to the website from the like yoga workshop. Jeremy's doing a Q&A rig rundown last year. Really great stuff. I've been to Legend Valley. Super cool, fun place. When are you going to do it next?
The intention is to do it next year. We've had to bounce. We've been doing Dome Fest, our festival, for upwards of 11 years or so. It got confusing with COVID, and we had like a party in the pods that was like, you know, like a socially distanced version. We had a stream when the pandemic hit called Home Fest. So it gets kind of confusing as for how many years it's been happening. Mm-hmm. The first one was in 2010. But it's such a special weekend. We were talking about Phish and their like big weekends, like their Labor Day thing or their MSG return or now the Sphere. Dome Fest is that thing for us. It's that once a year, like the cream of the crop, the cream of the flock. You know, they all mm-hmm. come and we try to make those shows particularly special. I mean, recently we did the History of Pigeons Playing Ping Pong set, where I told narrations between the songs, and they kind of went chronologically through the years, starting from those earliest days that we were talking about.
Sort of like a VH1 Unplugged kind of thing.
Yes, kind of. Nice. Yeah. So that was really cool. And we've done a number of cool things with that. And out of that was born the Dome Fest All-Stars, which is a live collaboration with past and present Dome Fest alumni. Yeah. We're actually, even though we're taking the year off this year, we're going to do a Dome Fest All-Star set in Harrisburg, PA in the first weekend of May. And it's going to be all
that's
your Pigeons.
That's the kickoff of this album's tour cycle.
That's next. It's our first one.
May 3rd in Harrisburg.
Yeah. And then May 4th, a Saturday, we're going to have a whole set with us and then Eli from Dopapod and Octave Cat, Brian on guitar from Spafford, and a whole lineup of great players. So to get back with your question, so Dome Fest is taking the year off, but we will be back next year. It's just one of those things that we care so much about that we want to do it right. And even though it's our first year off in however many years, we just didn't want to, you know, we wanted to make sure that all of our ducks were lined up, that we are confident to put on the show that everyone has grown to expect and deserve. And, a simple reset to make sure that when we come back next year, it's the best Dome Fest it's ever been.
And it's great that you guys are doing this domestically in a nice location, because like I just got back from My Morning Jacket, One Big Holiday in Mexico, and it's just open up the wallet for that one.
Yeah, it's fun though.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So it was a fucking amazing vacation. Gonna be in Legend Valley then next? Was it a venue thing?
We have bounced around a bunch, and that's never the intention. Our goal is to find a home that is our forever home. And among many things, that's part of the conversation. We want to make sure that we can, like, you know, resume with the confidence that we can build for years to come. And Legend Valley has been awesome. We've been at Marvin's Mountaintop. We've been in West Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania for a few years. So it's wonderful to be able to, like, keep it sort of within the region, but it is logistically challenging to have to jump around because all of the people you know, Jeremy and I organized the festival. We have brought in help in the latest iterations, but it was us for the first many years. And, like, all of the research and stuff you've done, like, oh, I have the best Portageon guy in the area. Well, once you move, that guy does, that's all mute. The amount of work that goes into it can't be understated, but it's always worth it. That said, it would be great if we didn't have to move around a bunch, for obvious reasons, and including the fans, so they can, you know, oh, you got to go to this tree at this time. The sunset's gorgeous. You know, like, it's nice to
and the
get
dinosaur looks especially good at this time of the evening.
Oh, yeah. Legend Valley dinosaurs. Yeah, but more on Dope Fest coming. Unfortunately, we're able to keep the tradition alive with the All-Star set, and then we... You know, Pigeons is linking up with Andy Frasco and Dogs in a Pile for the whole summer.
This was my next opportunity to talk. Yeah, this is my next talking point.
And Dome Fest is kind of a partner in that, like, putting together some past alumni to make it like a traveling circus.
Nice. Oh, well, in the meantime, going out with Frasco and playing a bunch of shows with Frasco, which I got to put on my radar, like Columbus, and I think there was another one in the Midwest.
There's a ton.
Yeah. All over. You're with Frasco. I had Frasco on the show. He's like pal now, and like, oh yeah, Jesus, just incredible stuff.
He's a good guy to have on a traveling circus.
Yeah, think.
the whole crew, man. Don't sleep on the other guys. They're all beautifully nuts
in the band.
Yeah.
Oh man, unbelievable. Yeah. Sean is like one of my favorite guitarists of all time. Their whole band is fantastic. Andy on drum. I mean, it's just incredible stuff, man.
Yeah, they're a great band.
Oh, and they just so keep absolutely getting better. I just saw them at the Metro here. Wow, blew me away. And they're just totally great dudes too. It was so much fun to hang out with them.
I what I'm excited about that is, like, Andy obviously brings a lot of energy, and I try to as well. And I think there's going to be, he's also a sports guy, I think there's going to be some really, like, positive, like, competition going on, like friendly competition to, like, raise the bar. Because if we're following Andy, like, I got to bring my rocket pack with me, and you know, so I think it's going to be positive. Right. Yeah.
100%. One more thing I wanted to talk to you about before I let you go. The Berklee music professor, you guys just sold out the Cap show back in February. Tomo Fujito's on guitar with you guys. What's up with that?
What's up with that? Tomo is the man. He is one of the best musicians I've ever played with. He's, for those who don't know Tomo Fujita, he's a Berklee professor of funk guitar, and he's had incredible students go through his mentorship, including John Mayer, Eric Krasno.
Oh, wow. Is he a recording artist as well?
He has his own music, and he has great songs, but he's primarily a teacher.
Okay.
And he's now working with Tom Misch. I don't know if you know him. He's a fantastic guitarist. He's from England. M-I-S-C-H. It's like a laid back jazz guitar with hip hop vibes, but it's very musical. It's like a swaggy, he's got such a chill, low voice. It's fantastic. You'll love it.
Cool. Yeah.
But Tomo is one of those guys that, you know, we actually found on Instagram and watch his incredible funk. His right hand both hands is just ridiculous. He's incredibly tasteful and so funky. His handle is on Instagram is Tomo Just Funky. Jeremy actually hit him up on Instagram. He slid into his DMs and said, hey, we're playing in Boston up by Berklee. Do you want to jam? All right.
Oh, this wasn't at the Cap?
Well, this was a prior Tomo show. A number of times. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think the first time might I just have noticed been at it a at music festival. Yeah, we've collaborated with Tomo probably a half dozen times, and this most recent one was, it only just gets better. He's not only a great player, he's a great listener. He's so tasteful with his playing, because he can, you know, blister and run circles around you if you want it, but he's more so serves the music and waits for his moment to shine in that regard, and we give him plenty of moments to shine.
Yeah,
but he's just What started with a DM on Instagram has blossomed into a truly incredible friendship. He is such a great guy. And every time we're around him, I get better. Like, you know, I just being around him, watching him warm up, asking him like, oh, what'd you just do right there? And he explains it clearly and shows me, and he's patient with me. And every time he plays with us, I get more tools in my toolbox. And
damn, how great is that? Wow,
it's incredible.
I mean, he's a professor. That's like what he oozes, apparently. Like, just
right.
Like,
and again, know. Like we did not. I studied communication. Jeremy studied business. We did not have that formal training. And especially, it's rare to have like a funk guitarist or a virtuoso just hanging around backstage. So he's incredibly generous with his time. And fortunately, he loves to play with us. He's from more of a like jazz community where, you know, there's some standards you might play and we'll take a 32 bar solo and then back to the song or what have you. So he finds the jam scene and our like openness, like, hey, we're going to, you know, once we hit this chord, it's kind of a free for all. We'll see where it goes together. Let's be patient and see where it goes. He was not really used to that. And it's incredibly freeing to get out of the box, especially if you've lived in the box so long in terms of like the structure of music. So he loves,
yeah, it must be super beneficial to him. Just being on that ride with you guys and, you know,
and catching the energy of the crowd.
Like, it's got to be completely invigorating from his perspective.
Totally. I mean, and it's pretty wild to feel as though while he can teach me all the technical stuff in the world, we can still, you know, he's an old dog who's open to learning a new trick about, you know, like letting jams sit, rise and fall and go where they go and have a second jam after that. You know, if the mood strikes just right and the energy, right. I think it's been beneficial for him too, which is unbelievable to say of someone who's been so talented for so long. He's the first to admit like, hey, this is really great for me. I never get to like, you know, I have so much time to build solos. Like I don't feel rushed. And that was so much fun. He's always like, I want like call me whenever. Let's go on tour. And I'm like, hey, man, you got students to teach.
Yeah. He's like, let's not go overboard.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing, dude. So last question, man. Touring. So you're now father of two. You guys have been on the road. You're doing hundreds of shows a year. Like, you know, clearly you had a break for like a year, year and a half-ish. And I say ish with the break because you were still playing, still doing live streams, but, being on the road and touring, what have you learned over the years that you can currently incorporate now to make your life, easier when you're on the road, especially with a couple kids at home?
I mean, even before the kids, you learn the hard way that like, you have to take care of yourself as much as possible because, you know, you roll into town and it's party night for that town. It could be Wednesday, Thursday, mm-hmm. Saturday, mm-hmm. whatever it may be. They're going out. They've gotten a, you know, babysitter that night or they've cleared their schedule. You have a show tomorrow, you know? Yeah. So,
right.
It, like,
don't fall. Oh, don't get sucked in.
It's very important for me to have the big picture in mind. Like I will sacrifice almost anything for the sake of tomorrow's show. So I've you know, granted you learn things the hard way, you know, fresh out of college going on tour. We had ourselves a few nights where I didn't feel super rested, but still gave it my all.
Yeah.
But I've just learned to, you know, pick and choose when it's time to cut loose or when it's time to get rest. I am very, like, similar to how I cut out cheese for the albums. I'm very, protective of like sleep on tour because the first way to lose your voice is to not get enough sleep.
Right.
And I don't think it's fair to anyone to let a selfish decision of like, oh, I want to hang with the guys for another hour affect tomorrow's show.
Because it's the talking and it's like you got music playing in the background. It's a party. It's that forced talking over music that crushes your voice.
And just like biology, man, like you need sleep to let your body rest and recover. So 100%. Like,
Just becoming more disciplined as you get older, I think I'm hearing.
Yes, more disciplined. But I've always kept the show in mind, you know, and I think that's, you know, some people are in bands for the ride or for what it comes with as opposed to like the music and the performance and whatnot. I'm very protective of the performance first and foremost. That said, the ride has been utterly incredible. And I think like, while you may miss out on that late night hang once in a while, we're still a band and people seem to still want to see us. You know, I've seen bands come and go.
The late night hang is for your own personal satisfaction. Maybe that would be fun to hang with the guys or whomever for like another half an hour, 45 minutes, but you keep the big picture in mind. It's the next show. It's the show after that. It's the whole 3 week leg or whatever you're doing.
If it's Saturday night and your next show's on Wednesday, by all means, have a hang. But like, if it's even, you know, Thursday on, you know, week one of three, like, come on, you know, but that's to each his own. You know, I'm also a singer, and I think like just the biology of that requires a bit more discipline, because you can't escape, you know, your voice getting tired if you're tired.
Right.
I also value the ability to like try to have the most energy in the room compared to the front row to the back row. Like I want you to challenge me to have more energy than me.
Yeah.
And with that comes like a little bit of forethought. You know, just how like I don't eat 3 hours I try to eat my dinner 3 hours before the show. So there's no pit in my stomach from that sloppy burger I had an hour ago. So right. I can't jump around. Like, I did that. I learned that the hard way. I had, you know, a poke bowl like 2 hours before we went on once, and the rice stayed in my stomach. So I didn't really feel like, I still do it, but I didn't really feel like jumping off the drum riser. But I'm like, well, fuck that. I mean, you made that decision. You got to get through it. Like,
yeah,
you know.
And so, dude, you get some air, man. Holy well, shit. Because, what the hell? Are those pictures doctored? You're literally fucking 7 feet off the ground. You better be taping your ankles as you get older, man.
Well, you know, it's because I'm fully digested my dinner. I have all this great energy. You know, I eat, I try to eat like salmon before every show as a clean protein. I don't eat red meat before shows. Like all these types of things that like aren't exactly what a, not that I'm a rock star, but like just the metaphorical rock star does not do is like, I worry about my diet. I make sure I have good sleep hygiene.
What's amazing now is that there's 81-year-olds out there that are fucking still doing it. Like, look at Mick Jagger. What is he eating? What's his pre-show routine? What is his fucking life routine?
What's his exercise regimen? Like, I don't think, you know.
Well, he's also like a super fucking tiny guy, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. But that means, you know, but muscle mass and bone density is going to decline regardless. And that means you got to watch out for falling or, you know, so you got to have strong feet, like we were talking about, the foundation. You got to have good grip, good strong feet.
Are you
strong
a yoga
ankles.
Practitioner?
No, you would think that, but I might be soon. But right now, I'm thinking more like we're talking about. I want to think about ways to work out that is functional to keep me doing what I love to do, which is play live music till I drop.
Yeah.
You know. So here's I want to make sure my back's good. I can hold a guitar for 3 hours in 40 years. That's how I'm going to start working out, you know?
Right on. Oh, man. Oh, I hope you're out there in 40 years. We're still rocking, man. I know you will be. I hope I'll be there with you. I'll try to make it for at least 20 of those.
Even if it's at a cabana in Southern Florida, I'll be there, you know?
Wait, which coast are they at?
My folks are on the East Coast. They're in Port St. Lucie.
Okay.
But my grandparents were like...
Isn't that Mets? Spring. It used to be Mets spring training.
It is. I think it might
it
be
still
both.
Is?
I don't know.
I know Vero Beach because I grew up in LA. That's Dodgers.
Okay.
Or used to be, at least. I don't know. A lot of them moved back out to Arizona.
Well, I was born and raised a Yankees fan, so hold against me.
Well,
sorry to mention the Mets
and end this on a sour note.
Oh, no. It's okay. But yeah, I love to play, man. I hope to continue to do it and truly feel like we're doing it for fun. So if that feeling doesn't fade and my body can take it, let's go.
Right on, man. Well, thanks for everything that you do, Greg. Thanks for being here. So glad I got to catch up with you. Day and Time, it's coming out on April 26th. Be there, be square, man. It's a great album. Looking forward to seeing you guys out on tour. Thanks again for being here, brother. It was so great to learn more about you.
Yeah, man. This was so fun. Thank you so much, man.
Right on.
I'm glad you're back in the States. And hopefully I'll catch you somewhere.
Yeah, well, I'll see you in Italy. I'll see you in the streets of Rome.
Oh, man. Yeah, I'll tell you what that archway is. I already forgot.
What archway?
Well,
did we do an archway?
I learned a lot about archways in Latin class, but clearly,
do you mean like historic arches that?
Yeah,
are
like all
like
the Colosseum
the
and the
oh, the whole like all like Roman arches that they.
Yeah,
there's the Arch of Titus. That's
Arch
just,
of Titus. That's what I was afraid to say. That's
the
what
Arch
I'm
of Titus
of.
Is just adjacent to the Colosseum in the Roman Forum, and I think it's the one that celebrate. It's like the Romans that are coming back from Israel or the Middle East, and they're carrying an actual menorah on in the Arch of Titus. Go
oh, really?
Google it and check it out.
Well, I guess Roman when we're in Italy together, you'll tell me about the archways and we'll have a great time in Italy eating cheese. How
oh,
about
I
that?
I would love that. Sounds good, man. Thanks for being here, brother.
Anytime, man.
Okay, that was me talking to Greg Ormond of Pigeons Playing Ping Pong, whose new album just came out on April 26th, entitled Day in Time. I feel it's like no secret that I'm a big fan of the band. Just so happy to have Greg on the show and just crack open his brain a bunch. And there's a lot in that brain, man. Greg's a super smart guy. Really loved so many of the things that he said during this interview. It's even difficult to kind of give a decent recap, but how we talked about different reactions from the crowd and what Greg's kind of expectations are, but well, not really expectations, but hearing what response of the crowd is for any particular show or song and sort of meeting that energy or exceeding that energy, taking cues from the energy of the crowd, and maybe things are not kind of a little bit lower energy, relatively speaking. I mean, they're always high energy at Pigeon shows, but you know, he can hear it from song to song, but tailoring or taking it as a challenge to take it to the next level. And he made a point of saying, even when that high energy is high, hey, he's like, oh, you think that's high? Well, we're going to go even a different level. Just that kind of really interesting drill down that I enjoy so much, and that Greg was really in lockstep with me, just going in all these different directions. And I really appreciate him for that. Really interesting to hear him talk about his family life. You know, he had his kids write, he had his daughter right after the pandemic hit, being able to spend time. But, you know, I forgot all about, you know, I mean, I kind of feel bad that now that I forgot about all that. But it was a real concern at the time of newborn's vulnerability to and to be immunocompromised at the time. And wow, that just must have been just crazy insane. It was insane for all of us. But you know, there was the aspect of being able to be at home and stay with and spend good quality time with your family at that time. You know, we were able to talk about the Sphere a little bit. Greg's a big sports fan and an athlete from going back. So I just kind of felt like I had a lot in common with Greg because, you know, I was an athlete. I have been an athlete my whole life, but also in high school, I was super into that, but also into music and, you know, kind of living with your feet in both of those worlds. But, you know, Greg's was so interesting, and it so checks out that he's also a big fan of musical theater and was performing musical theater in his school. And that went to his nickname of being Mr. Rome as well, which I think also tied into his Latin class and that whole group. So there was just so much common ground there. And I love Pigeons. I love the mashups that they do. They're such a unique jam band. If you hadn't had an opportunity to see them, I highly suggest you go out and see them. They've got tour dates throughout the whole summer. So you can go to their website to check out all of those tour dates. But they do these amazing mashups where they'll sandwich a classic rock song or sandwich a funk song within a larger jam of one of their bigger jam songs, and then weave in and out of them. And I just find it super interesting. And it gets to me because, as you heard throughout the course of this interview, I really, have jibe with Greg's musical foundation and all his interests, and that those of the band as well. And if you want to find out more information about Pigeons as well, I had Gator Alex Petropolis Gator on the show as well. That was from a mid-2021, really early interview with him. You can check that one out too. And of course, they put on their summer, their band festival, Dome Fest, which is going to be great. That'll be coming back in 2025. He's also touring with Andy Frasco this summer. I also had Andy on the show. You can go check out his interview as well. And make sure to go listen to their new album, Day in Time. It was out on April 26. It's a really phenomenal album. Some of their best work, I'd have to say. So thanks to all of you for sticking this one out. I was really so pleased to be able to bring you this amazing artist, Greg Ormont. And he's just a really super human being. So thanks again to all of you for being here. And I want to send a special thank you and shout out to Greg Ormont for being here. We got so many great episodes coming up. So I'll see you on the next episode of Roadcase. Thanks again so much for listening. And I'd like to encourage everyone to get involved with Roadcase. You can do so in a number of different ways. You can email me at info@roadcasepod.com with questions, comments, and even suggestions for guests. Or you can follow us on the socials, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We're at Roadcase Pod. And we have a YouTube channel called Roadcase Podcast. And of course, you can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite listening platform. And if you could please rate and review the podcast while you're there, that would be great. So I want to thank Waltzer for this awesome theme music that we have. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening to Roadcase. We have a lot of great episodes coming up, so I'll see you on down the road.